I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Bingo. So it's not the cymbal crash. It's the power chord. It's the bar chord on the guitar that I come in on. Now I know. Hey, folks, welcome. You're listening to Food Talk with Mike Colomeco here, Heritage Radio Network. If you like what you hear on the network, go online, give them some money. Yeah, that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? They do that. They ask for donations. They live by that. It's free. There's no commercials. It's streaming radio, and it's got tons of good content. We've got a good show for you today. Got a couple of great guests. Last week was a fun show. It was fun to have the new executive chef at Maria coming in. Lauren was great, and Alicia from the Red Gravy, Saul Balton's newest place in Brooklyn. So an all-female chef day. Today we're going old school. A couple of guys that I've known for a long time. Dan Silverman will be my first guest in a few minutes. Dan was most recently at the Standard in the Meatpacking District for a good long run and is now newly ensconced as the executive chef in the swank and fancy Regency Hotel up on Park Avenue that has been famous for years for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which has been their legendary Power Breakfast. I've never attended those. I don't know anything about those. But it's big.
Go.
It's the titans of industry, and it's the truth. It's kind of like lunch at the Four Seasons, and Michael's is kind of filling that space, too, in a way. But, yeah, it's where the movers and shakers and deal makers of New York gather, discuss our fates and the price of everything going forward. That's where it happens, at the Regency. But they're doing some really amazing stuff up there, so we're going to talk about what he's doing. I had dinner there this week. And it was really kind of neat, kind of fun to be uptown, and met some familiar faces in the dining room. So we'll talk about the team that they put together because it's pretty impressive and world class. Just this week, just filling up some time here at the beginning of the show, like I always do, talking about nonsense. It was funny. If you're in and around New York in the food world, the health department's become its own little entity. Back in the 80s, for those of you that weren't here, back in the 80s and even the early 90s, it was a whole different thing with the health department. It was completely corrupt. There was a time in the late 80s when the Brooklyn district attorney had subpoenas out for literally half of the health department inspectors. They were busted. They were on the payroll of restaurant owners. But it was good. It was a simple system. You'd hire consultants that you would pay, and some of that money took it out of the health department. And they kind of left you alone. And then this guy named Bloomberg came into office. And the health department became, like a few other things, a source of revenue. That's how I'm looking at it. Sorry, Bloomberg. But it kind of seemed that way. If you were in the restaurant business in the last 8 or 9 years in New York, it was so annoying because the Board of Health would come in, like they always do. They have about 110, 112 inspectors that theoretically they do every restaurant twice a year. Once a year. And that's 18,000 eateries. But they would just find stuff, like fines. And if you're a small restaurateur, if you're a small business guy, you know, to get fined for $4,000 or $5,000, that's big money. And you could appeal some of those. Maybe you couldn't. You get away with it. You went downtown. You spent some time. Maybe you could reduce it. But it's still a lot of money, and it was a pain in the ass, and it was usually over nitpicking nonsense. So per se had their inspection recently, and they had a grade pending for a while, which is what they do when they're trying to figure out what they're going to give you. And then I don't think they got an A. Did you hear this, Dan?
I don't know if they're finished yet.
I thought they got a C or something, and I will tell you.
I think the point equivalent was a C, but I think that they're contesting.
It's ridiculous. So it was it was kind of case in point. Now, apparently from my inside sources, Bill de Blasio is going to have a whole different take with the Board of Health. They're going to be a little less... They're going to act a little less like jerk-offs and hooligans shaking the restaurants down for money, and a little more like what they're supposed to be doing, which is making sure that you don't die eating in restaurants. But per se, for those of you that don't know, is arguably, and I would make the argument, having spent a good amount of time in that kitchen, during service, during mise en place, it is the cleanest, most efficiently run restaurant I've ever seen.
Most organized.
Organized everything. I mean, Thomas Keller is a rather anal chef to begin with. From the head down, that's how it works. Everything is labeled, covered, refrigerated, dated. You could eat off the floors. The teardown they do every night with that restaurant after service is legendary. The place is spotless. And I'm wondering if it's not that nitpicky stuff like, you know, according to the Board of Health in New York City, salad green, everything has to be kept at 38 to 42, right? I mean, if you eat salads that are 38, you can't taste them. If you're eating pâtés that's 38, you can't. If you're eating cheese that's 30, if you're eating charcuterie, that's the wrong temperature. So you can get fined for that sort of stuff. So it's really kind of, well, it's silly. And if you ever wanted a great case in point, the idea that Per Se got cited and scored a grade equivalent for a C is hysterical. So anyway, there. Done with that stuff. But maybe with de Blasio we'll see some change. Who knows? I had a great meal with Dan at the Regency. We'll talk about that meal when we bring Dan on here. Had a really fun time a week ago filming, not far from Dan, uptown. I've been uptown a fair amount this year, a place called Rouge Tomate, which is like a Michelin-starred health food joint. That's what I'm calling it. It's like really, really healthy food. Their reason to be is to make super healthy food, really healthy food, low-calorie food, whole-grain food, in a stealth way that you don't know you're really eating healthy food, but like it is. There's like an in-house dietitian that works with the chef, and they've got a sommelier named Pascaline Laputier who's amazing. Pascaline's one of my favorites, and she poured for me a red from the Finger Lakes. Now, I don't drink a lot of American wines. I don't. I drink mostly European wine, like 99%. And I'm like, a red from the Finger Lakes? I don't know. And
what was it?
It was called White Horse, which was the name, which is a tongue-in-cheek for Cheval Blanc. Because the blend was like a right bank blend. So the blend was Merlot and Cab Franc, mostly Merlot. But because of the elevation, it was like, if it was a blind tasting, no way. I would have said Loire Valley. I mean, I probably would have guessed Cab Franc because it had that kind of vegetal green pepper
right.
note to it.
That's what but I would
was,
think.
But because of the altitude up there and the short growing season, it was so restrained compared to American reds.
Right.
It didn't have that ripeness, didn't have the big sugar, didn't have the high alcohol. It was like this beautiful, lovely wine. And then just a couple days after that, I ate with Pascaline Wednesday night. Friday night, I was at Minetta Tavern, which is known for having, supposedly known for having a really interesting and eclectic wine list. I found it really expensive. It was interesting if $100 and up doesn't bother you. That bothers me. So it wasn't that great a wine list on the low end, but I found another Cab Franc from another producer, another Finger Lakes Cab Franc. It was like $68
now. Interesting, because I know the whites are.
We know the Rieslings, right? They do really Rieslings great. And they do sparkly wines. And I had never thought. I mean, so this was I'm like 57. I'm a million years old, and I never. I mean, I know they grow shitty, like they grow like what's that Concord grape? Some of the red varietals
the
they
foxy
grow.
Grapes.
Yeah, there's just those box wine, horrible, like the kind of wines you and I would never drink if our life depended on it. And I knew the Rieslings were good and their sparkling wines were good. But the idea, this one couple, the wine that I had at Minetta was, I believe, organic bio, husband wife, small field. They run it with horses. I mean, it's like old school.
Cool.
Anyway, all right. So let's get on with the show. Enough nonsense. Let me introduce Dan Silverman. Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. Hey,
no, pleasure, man. So tell me your story. I'm always curious. We've never – I think the first time we actually met in person, was at the restaurant this past week. How did you get into business? Where and when and why?
Well, where? My first job was at Restaurant Boulay, and I started working there shortly after he opened the original place in 88, and I got that job – I think I was still in cooking school.
What a place to start, dude.
It
Talk
was
about
great.
Starting at the
it
top.
It was great. It
How'd
was,
that happen?
I walked in. I mean, again, you know, we were having a conversation early on talking about how, you know, the job hunting right. process in this business has changed. And back then, you walked in the back door. You walked in the kitchen door, and you asked to see the chef. And you presented the chef with the resume. And you tried out for the job, and sometimes that was a five-minute conversation, and sometimes it was a week-long extravaganza. And I got put on, I worked the Amuse station for a couple of weeks until somebody till there was a vacancy, let's put it that way, and then Hot Apps, and then over the course of several years, I worked pretty much every station in that kitchen, and it was a great experience.
Yeah, that was great. For those of you that don't remember, it was a very different town then. We talked about how, I mean, the jobs that I was getting back then, I worked for the French guys, I worked for the Four Seasons, and then my next job... Long story short, who cares about me? But with Four Seasons and then Delouvrier, but to get jobs, then you would go to your chef after a couple of years and say, "Chef, I love you, but I've been here. I've worked every station. I'm ready to move on." And he would pick up the phone and call other chefs, or a guy like Mark Sarrazin Sr., who knew all the other chefs, and they knew where the openings were. There was no Craigslist, there was no internet. These jobs weren't posted in the New York Times. It was
total word of mouth,
complete word of mouth,
word of mouth and personal recommendation.
And if you fucked up, you were done. I mean, really,
you screwed somebody over.
Done. Leave town.
No fly.
Try Philadelphia, try Boston, reinvent yourself somewhere else because you'd be banished. And so that was the time when, like, a restaurant opening, there would be one a year. Now the restaurant openings are
like 10 a season. How many a week?
Right. Yeah. It's like you read the Wednesday Times with Fabricant Singh. It's like, oh, shit, I've got six more places to hit before the next Times lands on my doorstep next Wednesday. Then it was like Bernardin would open one year, Montrachet would open one year, Union Square would open one year, and
exactly.
then Belay was this huge opening because David had 3 stars. With Drew Nieperant,
Montrachet,
just the year before.
Yeah.
Drew basically couldn't get – he offered David a partnership. David didn't want it. Drew couldn't get the food out of the kitchen fast enough to make the kind of money that he was looking to get. And he hired a new crew in stealth, trained them at the River Cafe, and David showed up at work one day, and his shit was outside.
Out,
and Drew said,
out.
We're done, dude. Bye. Yeah. Sorry. You know, you didn't catch the vapors. I've been telling you this was going to happen. And that day they opened up with a new chef and a new menu. Crazy stuff. And then as Drew and David didn't talk for years after that. Hey,
exactly.
And Drew always said the best thing I ever did was can David, because what did he do? He opened up Boulay, which was an unbelievable restaurant. I mean, so you were there at a restaurant. That was the restaurant of the year that opened.
Yeah.
That was just amazing. Mixed reviews
amazing.
At the beginning. Then they got their shit together. So talk about that kitchen. Because David, like you, David's a chef. David's on that freaking line.
I tell people about that experience, and it was amazing in a lot of ways, but I mean, the most amazing thing about it was you worked and worked and worked, and you know, you all day long you ran to get your stuff done, to be ready for service. I remember one time, like towards the end of my tenure there, I think I was the AM sous chef, I was the opening sous chef, and you know, trying to figure out, you know, what the specials were for lunch, it was detective work. You had to, you know, you had to look in all the reach-ins, you had to look in the walk-ins, you had to read the specials list from the day before. And I remember one day, you know, thinking, I'm like, okay, I'm set. I've got it all ready. And, you know, there was some Rouget dish on the specials list. And he wouldn't come in sometimes until 12:30, 12:45, and lunch starts at 12, you know, and we'd seat the dining room. And so there was this Rouget dish. I didn't know, you know, I had some ideas about what it could be. And, you know, he came in, he's like looking at the mail, getting ready to, you know, come on the line. I said, "Chef, you know, how does the Rouget go?" And he said, "Why, did you get an order for one?" And I said, "No, not yet." He said, "Well, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out." You know, and then he got dressed and he was on the line. And then the first order came in for the Rouget and he asked me for something that I didn't have on the line. He said, "Well, you're not set up. What's up with that?" Run. Okay, we're ready.
Okay, I need tomato water now.
Yeah, exactly.
I need brunoise and celery. I need right now.
Something like that.
That's so Boulay.
Yeah.
He's so crazy.
But I mean, that experience is just so formative and so amazing in that way. It was just great.
It was to this day, I think, one of the most beautiful dining rooms I've ever sat in New York City.
Awesome dining room.
You would
room.
Step off of Duane or whatever the street was. I remember those big oak doors that he brought in from France, and the apple, there was always this pile of fruit apples or something. And then you'd enter this dining room with that vaulted ceiling, very much reminiscent of like how they do coffer wine cellar ceilings.
Yeah.
But the sense of space between the tables, the floor, it was like 3-star Michelin. Relais and Chateau, European. Nobody was doing that standard in America then.
Totally.
Nobody.
Gorgeous.
It was. You were in France until you walked outside again. For that 3 hours
later.
hours, because, God, that kitchen was slow, dude.
Well, we made, I mean,
slow.
The food didn't go out until it was ready.
It was insane. I remember sitting down with my GM. I was at the Ritz-Carlton. My GM took me in. We knew David. And I remember we ordered food, ordered wine, and we had literally finished the entire bottle of wine that we'd ordered to go with what we had gotten nothing beyond Amuse-Bouche. It was
another,
an hour.
Another bottle of wine, perhaps? Yes, correct.
So that's amazing. So after Boulay, what?
After Boulay, let me think. Long ago.
It is long ago. Dude, all right, I don't know.
After Boulay, I think I landed at Allison on Dominic Street.
With Tom Valenti? After Valenti?
After Valenti, okay. And Scott Bryan had been before, had preceded me briefly, and I was at Allison for about 5 years.
Great spot, busy spot.
Food and Wine, Best New Chef, Gourmet Magazine.
Oh, good, that's huge. That's a July issue.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge.
1997.
Boulay, too. One last footprint just about Boulay, because there's a lot of things I can say about David that aren't positive. None of them have to do with him being a chef. They have to do with him being a businessman.
Amazing chef, though.
Amazing chef. A chef. He was really the first American superstar. Before Keller, before anybody, he was the guy. He had used Dieter Schirner's recipe for creme brulee to get a job working for Robuchon. Because he'd worked with Dieter at Vienna 79, and Dieter had this great creme brulee recipe. I don't know if you remember Dieter, but Dieter was one Dieter was a great pastry chef, and Dieter gave David Boulay this sort of proprietary. And when he went to see Robuchon said, "So what do you do? Make something, give me something." And he did creme brulee. Was like, "Whoa!" So he worked for Robuchon, came back to the States, and David blew up to the point where when Robuchon would come to New York, he would cook with David. And this was the first time. Like, this was Robuchon was the hottest guy in the world at the time. I mean, Jamin was 3-star Michelin, the gold standard. Yeah. And so I really think David was the first, before Keller, before anybody, that kind of was an international celebrity chef who was American-born and was recognized by the French for what he did. But anyway, that's enough with David. So let's talk about what you're doing uptown, because I could go on and on. You were at the Standard. Obviously, you got a full-on great resume. How did you hear about the job uptown at the Regency? How did that come about?
A little bit old school. I am a friend of... a parent of one of my daughter's friends writes for a magazine. She was interviewing the managing director at the Regency. You know, I think it was a long lead piece about the design. Somehow my name came up as a mutual friend, and my friend said, "Oh, you know, I met a friend of yours who's, you know, now at the Regency. You know, he said he'd, you know, love an opportunity to work with you again." And we, you know, I reached out to him, we had a conversation, and then boom, boom, boom. A couple of weeks later, I had a new job.
Completely redid the space.
Apparently, I had never been.
Well, there was that restaurant that was famous for the breakfast, because it's true. I mean, there were God knows how many billions of dollars of deals were transacted over morning coffee at the Regency. It was a scene, in the same way that the Four Seasons Grill Room at lunch is, Michael's to some extent is. New York is the capital of so many things, and those people have to go somewhere. And that was like the A table in your high school cafeteria where all the cool kids sat and you wanted in.
It's got to be high school, huh?
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess. But aside from, and there was Michael Feinstein's kind of cabaret thing in there, which was kind of cool because it was like a New York thing and kind of an institution. So totally rebuilt. Talk about the opening, because openings, for those of you that have never done a restaurant open...
Don't do it.
Talk about
It's my third in a row, I think, actually.
Well, then you're getting good.
Yeah, I don't know why. Third in a row. It was just... they're always challenging. They're always pressure cookers. This one was just, you know, it was challenging in different sorts of ways than other ones. You know, we needed to be open... The Tishes are, you know, part owners of the Giants, so there was a big push to...
What don't they own? I mean, they basically own half of New York City.
God bless
in
them.
In some way.
God bless them.
We should have been born into the family or married into it, but unfortunately we use the employees' entrance and tie
aprons on. Yeah, so, I mean,
on.
so we, you know, we made that date, and, you know, it was... And since then, we've just been, you know, working on stuff and tweaking and changing stuff and trying to put new things on plates, and, you know, we're really getting there.
How many months ago did they open?
Months? We opened January 16th.
So a month. Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
that's huge.
Six weeks now.
Talk a bit about the team, because they're not playing. I mean, they are. I mean, the motivation must be to get, you know, shake shake the tree and get some press, get maybe get the Times in, get Wells in. I don't know if Platt's
love
worth
to.
I don't know if it's worth getting Platt in anymore because everybody seems to get 2 stars or less with Mr. Nobody Impresses Him Anymore guy. But the Times is still the gold standard. But so I'm sitting down at the table. You and I have never met. Get the menus. I was with my son and his girlfriend, which is kind of fun because it's fun going out with
Were you chaperoning? I was confused by that.
No. I've known them. They were high school sweethearts. So they've been going out for 6 years. They're like an item. 6 years they've been
going out. Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, how cool is that? I know.
That
it's like
is
true
cool.
love or something. I don't know why she puts up with his ass, but that's a whole other story. She's like everything he's not. She finished college on time, is doing a graduate degree, doesn't smoke, doesn't drink, doesn't take drugs. I pulled him out of college after 4 years because he smoked, he drank, and he took. You know, it was like, whatever. They are like opposites, but she's great. But anyway, you've on the floor, you had a sommelier, or actually your beverage director, that I recognized from years ago when he was the sommelier at Ducasse, when Ducasse was behind the Essex House. Thought he was brilliant then. He was with Leal for a while as a group overseeing everything.
Right.
Then he was with Benoit, where I saw him on the floor.
Right.
Talk about him. Because, I mean, you have your core team, and you could mention their names and talk about their bios, but you kind of have this dynamic with pastry and you and the front of the house in terms of the beverage.
Well, I mean, first of all, my team, the guys and ladies of the kitchen have been great. My chef de cuisine is this guy, Rich Corbo. My executive sous is Brian Kevorkian. They work together at Gary Danko together, and they just bring a lot of great ideas to this table. My pastry chef, Jeff Seitzma, is great. He's been at Oceana. He worked with Paul LeBrant for a while. Great sensibilities, all of them. Great flavor profiles that are kind of simpatico with what interests me, and just great people to work with. And when you're doing an opening, you're spending
a lot of time
to put it delicately together. And it's nice to be able to spend that much time with a bunch of people that you can really get along with and speak the same language with. So
it's
very happy to have all of
them. Cannot overemphasize that. When I was at the Maurice with Christian Delouvrier, he was young and he was pretty feisty back then. And we had a consulting chef named Alan Sondrens, who was 3-star Michelin in Paris. He was at Orchestrat.
Great restaurant.
And every 3 months, we would change the menu entirely. And Sondrens would fax us the new menus, and Christian and I would play with, I mean, remember, like ripping off pieces of paper in French. Christian would translate them, and I was getting pretty good at reading French recipes.
Right.
We would make simulacrums of the dishes, our best attempts at them. And then he would fly over. We would close for a week and work on the new menu,
right.
And we would open on a Saturday night with a gala. And to your point, and again, people out there listening, those weeks we worked so many hours that literally, if you were like the sous chef or the pastry chef, they'd put you upstairs in the hotel.
Yeah,
because you would go to bed at 1 a.m. and they wanted you back downstairs at 6:37, and there was just a sense of, why bother wasting an hour going home and coming back, dude? We'll just put you in a room.
Exactly.
Same thing with you.
Yes.
It's
true.
Unfucking believable.
True.
Like, you're on your feet for 17, 18 hours. You go to bed, brush your teeth, have a beer, pass out, wake up, and put your whites on, and you're back in the saddle again.
All of it true.
Great business.
It is a great business, though.
It is.
It's fun.
We love it. We wouldn't get out of it, right? Yeah, it's true. It's great. So you have a core team that you've gotten along with.
Yeah, so a great core team, but you were talking about André Compère, who's great, whose knowledge is just amazing. He's got a great personality, and he's got that training from working for Ducasse for so long, which is awesome.
And he thinks out of the box. It's not like, sometimes there was always this fear of Soms of, always going to come to the table and I'm going to tell him what I want and he's going to, suggest a Pomerol 61 or a Cheval Blanc. No, you kind of tell him, here's what I like and here's my price range. And I just remember him bringing these wines to the table. They're like, some of them I knew, some of them I didn't.
Right.
Even when he was at Ducasse, when I used to eat at Ducasse, it was a little table off the kitchen called the fish tank. Had those glass doors open because I didn't like the dining room much and, whatever. And if you had juice, he would put you back, and if it wasn't sold out, he'd put you in the kitchen with it. So it was like your private dining in a way. And I remember him bringing one of the tasting menus, him bringing like a Slovenian red.
He's into that. We were just talking about Slovenian wines.
It was like 2001, and I'm like, what? There's viticulture in Slovenia? I mean, this guy's big. This guy's deep.
Yeah.
Crazy. And then what is the young lady's name who's on the floor that used to be at LTO or whatever the one is in
Chicago? Chantel Pabros.
Totally
cool.
She's
also amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So
really good team.
Great team. So, I mean, obviously you guys are swinging for the fences.
Knock on wood, yeah.
Okay, good. Talk about the menu a bit, because it's you are uptown, so we're it's not a lot of dots, not a lot of foam, not a lot of stuff that I didn't recognize on the plate.
No, but I mean, I wouldn't be doing that anyway. I really kind of like food to taste like food and to look like food. Not that there's anything wrong with
doing it. It's a personality.
Several different ways, but
right.
I mean, for me, there's nothing wrong with a nice plate of something. Insert a animal, fish, or vegetable here. You know, our lamb plate is, a double cut like an English chop. It's marinated with yogurt, herbs, some spice, and then grilled, and it gets, gets nice and caramelized in the char broiler. It's just served really simply with chickpea panis and mint béarnaise. So, it's very recognizable food, but hopefully, the products are sourced really well, great meat. And everything is cooked properly, and we're respecting that. And what could be bad about that? In fact,
yeah, the answer is nothing.
It's quite good.
Yeah, I've always thought that sort of my philosophy is almost like I shouldn't mention me and Ferdinand Point in the same sentence. But Ferdinand Point's one of those mid-century, last-century chefs in France.
One of my favorite cookbooks, by
the way. Absolutely. Yeah. Yours, mine, and a lot of chefs I know. Yeah. And Point was sort of post-Escoffier, post-Carême. Went Carême, then Escoffier, and then Point as a giant. And Point had a little restaurant called Le Pyramide. He was famous for the copious amounts of champagne he would drink during the day.
Yeah.
But he was such a chef, and he is really the beginning of the modern chef in the fact that he...
Sourcing locally,
yes. Buy the best ingredients, don't get in the way,
yes.
Simplifying things. He sort of really pared down Escoffier's technical prowess. It wasn't required in his mind. And also, even for people like us, breaking that door between the customer and the chef, Escoffier wasn't in the dining room ever. Chefs were not allowed to wear whites outside. They came in the back, employee's entrance, suited up, stayed there, changed, and went home. And Point was really the first guy, your guy Boulet, who would have the beautiful chef's whites with a tie underneath it and a button-down shirt. That was Point. He was the first guy to break that door, too. So he wasn't just he was a chef that was a patron, but it was something that hadn't happened before. And all the Nouvelle guys worked in that kitchen. I think 12 or 13 of the guys that would go on to become the next generation stars did their piece there. So I'm with you. I mean, in terms of that philosophy. And I mean, talk about sourcing ingredients now in New York, too, because it's so much better than when I was a young chef in this city. And even when you started in the 80s.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think that, a lot of things have changed it all. I mean, I think that, the internet, at least in this case, is a force for good because all the information is out there. If you want to find an ingredient or you want to read about an ingredient, the world's at your fingertips. As far as the sourcing goes, I think that, there are a bunch of purveyors that have been in business for a long time that do really great stuff. And... we use Pat Lafreda for meat.
It's Creekstone, man. I had that
Lafreda de Braga.
Yeah, they're great. They're rivalry, but it's okay.
They're both great.
Both great. Yeah,
they're both great. So it's just a function of developing those finding those people, developing relationships with them, cultivating that relationship. I love to get on the phone and talk to Mark or to Pat Jr. and pick their brains. It's so interesting to talk to, people in that end of the business about our end of the business because, you school them and at the same time they school you, which is always a great conversation to have.
Yeah. Yeah. And fish, you're using Lou Razzo among others?
I'm not using Lewis right now. I use Peerless.
Yeah, brought Bobby Damasco.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I've known him for a long time as well.
He's fun. And his wife's a great pastry chef.
Yes, Karen is super talented.
Great, great talented pastry chef. They're a great story. He's crazy. I love him. But the butter you can get, the bread that you can get. I mean, the truth is in America now, the ingredients are just so much better than they were 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean,
the small farmers, the little boutique vegetable. I mean, it's basically the crayon box we can play with now is so much more interesting than the one we were
stuck
with.
So we have 128 colors instead of 64 or 32 or whatever.
Or 8.
Yeah, or 8.
And a lot of brown.
Primaries, yeah, and white. Yeah.
No, it's great. So, super, super. And the Tishes must be behind this. I mean, obviously, they've invested a ton.
Yeah, they're great. They're a pleasure to work with. John is in charge of the hotels, and he's just been a great guy to collaborate with.
How many women are in your kitchen? A fair amount now?
Women.
Women chefs?
Yeah, actually.
I'm curious about this. I'm seeing more and more women on the, you know, in kitchens that I go on. I know, like, the FCI is like half women in terms of enrollment.
Four sous chefs, one's a woman. Let's see. Lunch, I have 2-3 on the line. Yeah.
Okay, it's good. It's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, there's really, it's tough. I mean, I devoted last week's program to talk to, I mean, Lauren, who just got promoted to chef de cuisine from Marais, which is great, 3 stars.
I mean, my experience is that they're some of the best cooks.
Good. There we go.
They try harder because they feel like they have to, and I don't, you know, I'm not sure. They're just
good.
They're
good
just
news.
Solid.
What's your advice, young chefs coming up? Because one of the things our industry's changed. It's gotten more popular. I mean, thank God I can actually make a living doing something like TV and radio and writing, which is such horseshit. Because when I started, if you dreamed big, it was, I want to be a chef. I want to own my own restaurant. Maybe. You know, that was it. That was it. That was about as far as anybody was ever going to go. But having said that, I think a lot of kids getting in this industry now, you know, they watch Top Chef or they watch Chopped and it looks cool.
Do it because you love it. Don't do it because you think it looks cool.
Yeah. And because
it looks cool on the outside, but it's, you know, it depends on your perspective. But I mean, for me, I always tell people that cooking is just managing an endless flow of mistakes. You know, you fuck something up. You have to admit that you made the mistake. You have to, you know, you have to figure out what you did wrong and then move on. And yeah, you make other mistakes. You know, it's like I always say, or, you know, like you use the Fernand Poin. I think he used to have people cook an omelet for him. That was how you auditioned. And, you know, I always say to cooks, I can show you how to make an omelet. And if you make it my way 15 times perfectly, you still don't know how to make it because you've never fucked it up. You know, and it's in those mistakes that you actually learn how to cook, and you learn that the products are, you know, the product is the same every day. An egg is an egg. But, you know, depending on what time of year or what kind of chicken it comes from or what that chicken was eating or being fed determines the quality of the egg, determines the moisture content, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you learn by repetition. You know, you really do.
It's funny. I remember the old days when I think it's less of a position now than it used to be because cooking has changed so much. But we used to dream about being the saucier in a restaurant back in the 80s because that was, or 90s, because it was, you were the guy that made every. Yeah. So you just came in the morning and it was reductions and bones and hollandaise and béarnaise and breaking them and fixing them. Back to your comment of eggs, it's just, you know, depending on the day, the temperature, where the room was, the butter, if you were in a hurry. I mean, you know, how many times did we bring back broken hollandaise and béarnaise in the middle of service?
Yeah,
it's funny.
Completely.
Dan, it's been great to have you. Dan Silverman's the chef at the Regency Bar and Grill.
Regency Bar and Grill, Lowe's Regency Hotel.
Lowe's Regency Hotel, 64th and Park
Avenue.
61st, excuse me. Mike. Sorry, the subway 63rd. That's how I know stuff. The F train stops up there. That's how I roll. No, great restaurant, really beautiful. Keep an eye on them. They've got a great staff in the kitchen. He's brought his core A-team with him. And I really liked what I saw in the front of the house. Great wine program, great somm on the floor, great beverage director. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. And,
no, continued success. Nice to chat. Great
to
have
great.
You. Folks, you're listening to Mike Lomeco's Food Talk here on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to take a quick spot to give a shout out to some of the people that helped make my program and some of the others here possible. And I'll be back in a couple of minutes with another seasoned New York vet, Chef Shane McBride, who is the executive chef for Keith McNally, who oversees specifically Balthazar, Pastis up until recently, Mineta, the soon-to-open Cherche Midi, and Schiller's down in my neighborhood. Shane and I will talk about what it's like to run that beast right after this.
Sunny. Hey folks, Mike Colometco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. What is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano.
Mike Colometco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet. Pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil and baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Hey, folks, welcome back. There was a moment of silence there. You know why there was a moment of silence? Because we're at Roberta's, and this is the Church of Brooklyn. And we bowed our heads for a moment here in the pews of the Church of Brooklyn, all things great in the culinary world. A moment of silence here at the church. Okay, but we're back now. My guest is Shane McBride. He's in the studio, and you know what? He's a chef. He brought me a bottle of wine, a Corbière, a wine that I love from the Sud de France. Kind of like Minervois, same sorts of wines in a way. All right, so that was the sound of the corkscrew. Look at that color. It's gorgeous wine. We'll get Shane on microphone in a minute, but not before I take a sip of this wine. I'm going to talk about, again, these are sort of, God, that smells good. Thank you so much. Toast. So last week, again, we were celebrating some bright young women in the industry. Lauren Destaino, who was the chef de cuisine is the chef de cuisine now at Marea, which is great. She was tough as nails. She was a great interview. And Aisha, who is now the chef de cuisine at Red Gravy, which is Saul Bolton's homage to Southern Italian cooking in Brooklyn. I remember her when she worked with Missy Robbins, who's another great, great woman in the industry, at Avoce. Aisha's cool. She was great. The interviews were great. Today we're kind of switching gears and getting some grizzled guys that have been in this business thing almost as long as I have. To that end, we had Dan Silverman earlier, who started out amazingly with David Boulay in one of the greatest kitchens ever to grace New York City back when he opened in 87, 88. And is now the executive chef at the Regency. And Shane McBride, who I first met, 12 or 13 years ago when he was one of the line cooks or sous chefs of Christian Delouvrier's L'Espinasse, one of the greatest restaurants to ever exist in New York. Shane, welcome, man.
Thanks for having me, man.
Great to have you on. Great to have you on. Thanks for the wine. So talk a bit about, you know, I ask everybody this, but I love the stories and I love the narratives. What got you into this business in the first place? I'm just always curious what drove people in here.
Well, for me, it was sustenance. My mom, I had a single mom who was building her business kind of from the ground up. And she was just an awful cook.
And so was mine.
She had a repertoire of like maybe five things, you know, meatloaf, beef stroganoff, stuffed peppers, and like chicken cordon bleu, and they all sucked. And you can only eat those things so many times. So my grandmother's a fantastic Southern cook, and my uncle was a chef, so I had them to lean on. So I would watch them and learn from them. You know, like fried chicken from my grandmother and shit like that. But that was it. It was just so I could eat. So as soon as I could reach the top of the stove, I was cooking for myself.
That's funny.
And I kind of grew. It's funny, you know. I kind of grew up. I was a little bit of a party boy in high school. You know, I played football and all that shit. And I used to have big parties at my parents' house. My mom's company, you know, got her away from the house a lot. So I would have parties where we would have 10 kegs over the course of a weekend, and I made money doing it. And somebody asked me just recently, you know, how'd you really get into this? I'm like, you remember the parties I threw in high school where we would have barbecue and sell the red cup for $3? I'm like, I replaced it with crystal glass and a real plate. I'm still doing the same thing, and I still love doing it. So
that's hysterical.
Yeah.
Cooking school at some point or no?
Yeah, I went to CIA.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. Graduate when?
I graduated in 97.
Mm. Where were you before I met you at L'Espinasse?
I worked for Charlie Palmer at Oriole. Yeah.
Great. You know, it's funny. We were just talking about David Boulay. Charlie is of that generation of, like, the first star American chefs.
Yeah. Boulay and Charlie worked for Rachou.
Correct. And yeah. Jean-Jacques Rachou, again, for those of you who don't know, a while back I was really honored and to have the privilege. Jean-Jacques Rachou was a French immigrant to the United States who was an orphan in France. He was orphaned. Really, he was adopted by people who basically treated him like an in-house slave. He slept in the barn, took care of animals. Yep. His life was miserable. At 12, he got a job in a hotel. He remembers the date. It was September 18th, 1940-something. It was the greatest thing to ever happen to him. Worked his way up, came to New York, La Vendue, and then Le Cote Basque, which really, they have their roots going back to the Pavillon of that generation. He was so cool because if you wanted to work at Lutèce then or any of the French restaurants, they would not hire Americans. You could come in the summer and replace somebody while they were off, but you couldn't get a job permanently. He was the first guy to hire them. First guy. They threw him out of the Vitel Club. So anyway, I mean, I adore Jacques Rachou. And yes, Charlie Palmer, Rick Moonen, Frankie Crispo. I could go on. Dozens of that generation chefs came out of
David Burke.
Out of that kitchen. And then David Burke replaced River Cafe, which was huge. Well, I mean, that's with Charlie's stepping out party. He met Steve Zolas and then opened up Uptown, and the rest is history. And David won the that great French award. I think the only American to get that, right?
MOF.
Milieu
ouvrier de France.
Milieu ouvrier de France. Yeah. Amazing. David Burke's a serious chef.
Yes.
If you can just peel back the alcohol and drugs.
He said that. I didn't say that.
That's true with a lot of chefs. Most of us have CD pasts.
Yeah, that's true.
So you worked with Oriole and then with Christian.
Yeah, before Oriole, I worked in South Florida, Four Seasons, and a couple places down there.
So let's talk about what you're doing day-to-day, because we can go on and on about history, but you got the job a while back working with a team that had been ensconced there, Riyadh.
Yeah.
What's the other cat's name?
Lee
Hansen.
Awesome guys.
Yeah. Totally chefs.
Absolutely.
For those of you Keith McNally is one of the most successful restaurateurs ever to grace the earth. He opened Odeon years ago with his first wife and his brother. Then they opened Café Luxembourg, and it's been one after another string of successes.
Yep.
They kind of parted ways. He's a marriage or so later. Keith still runs some of the best, most popular, and most profitable restaurants in the city. Balthazar, Pastis, Minetta Tavern now for the last 5 years, Schiller's down in my neighborhood, and the soon-to-open Cherchez Midi, which is a redo of Polino's. Let's just talk about Balthazar a bit, for the beast it is.
Okay.
There was a New York Times piece I read a couple of months ago. Great piece. Don't know who the writer was. Wasn't Jeff Gordinier. Wasn't the usual suspects. But some kid. Talk about that kid, what he did and what he captured. Because I thought he really got the zeitgeist of what a restaurant like Balthazar is like as a machine.
He did. He came in. His name is Willie.
Okay.
I can't think of his last name, but he came in and he spent literally 22 hours in the restaurant straight. He came in at like, he got there like 4 in the morning. Aaron, who you met, the general manager, met him there. And he saw the porters cleaning. And then he saw the trucks coming up. You know, like we don't get the little delivery trucks. We get the big ass, full ass, big fucking trucks pull up to us. So he saw that. They videotaped like, you know, the 25, 60 cases of potatoes coming off, you know, per service. And he really just kind of watched the whole thing. And he had worked as a server in a restaurant. So he had a perspective of what it is, the day-to-day. And he really took it from that, I think. You know, he watched how the guys do stuff. And he talked to the guys. And he really just watched. And he translated. You know, it was like, I think it could be, you compare, I, you know, it's a big comparison, but like, compare what he wrote to like George Orwell, you know, Down and Out, Paris, London, where the guy was kind of like there. He was entrenched and watched it. And it was very cool to see him go through it. And then the other interesting part of it was the photographer did the same thing. He came in for 22 hours and took pictures. He must have taken thousands of pictures. I can only imagine how many pictures there were.
These days with digital media, that's exactly
what they were. Yeah, I mean, thousands of them. And there was some great pictures. There's there was the article in the magazine, but there was a really cool expose on the internet where they did like the day in the life of a steak frite. And they showed, you know, the big giant cases of the Creekstone meat coming in and the butchers taking it down and, you know, butchering it, pounding it out. The couple guys that peel potatoes all day long and then punch them out for the fries, and then the fry process. You know, they put one of those Go cameras on one of the guys and
GoPro.
Followed him all day, peeling potatoes, punching them out. It was great.
It really captured. I really like it when people, because so much of food writing, in my opinion, is just like horseshit from people who have never spent a day in the industry, don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
It might be good writing, but it's not. It's informed. This was peeling the layers of the onion and showing you what was back there.
You know, and to be, I hate to be a little negative, but there was lots of, on the Times website, there was lots of negative
comments
about how, you know, the article talked about how guys have been there peeling potatoes for so long and how that's like, you know, slavery. And, you know, these guys, this is what they want to do.
It's the restaurant business, dude.
They have been offered time and time again to be, you know, why don't you do this, why don't you do that? They want to just come in, do their job. They take their money back to whatever country they're from. And 10 years from now, they're going to retire and live like kings.
Yeah, you know, it's funny.
And I hate it. I hate to be that way.
But I didn't read the comment thing. I usually avoid that because it's sort of like Yelp. I mean, once you give people, you give any jerk off a computer and access to make a comment, and what you have is a lot of jerk off opinions.
There's a great friend of mine who's a manager at the Met dining room. He says, you know, in the 60s and 70s, they were called crackpots. And now they're called bloggers.
Yeah. I don't want to shit on all of them, but man, I'll tell you what, it's a sad sort of truth to a lot of what passes for journalism in that whole blogosphere and Yelpsphere thing. But you're right. Keith McNally has had employees that have worked for him, busboys that have worked for him since Odeon, that own buildings in Chinatown.
That is correct.
Could retire tomorrow on what they love working for Keith. They love the restaurant business.
Yeah.
They love the repetition of it. They love the daily routine of it. This is what they do. And I think nobody embodies that. I mean, so I had the pleasure. I mean, we did a piece on you. It's going to air in a couple of weeks. We did a piece on Mineta and on Balthazar for my PBS series that airs Sundays at 3:30 here on Channel 13. And I had dinner at Balthazar ahead of the shoot, and it captured. Talk about the place a bit, but it's there's something wonderful about those rooms.
Yeah,
the volume level is perfect.
Yeah,
there is just a buzz, and I've eaten at all of the great French brasseries that you could think of, from Flo to Pic to, you know, Julien, you name it. I mean, when I was in the 80s, that's all we did was go to Europe, go to France in the summers on our days off, our weeks off, and eat at those restaurants to get that sense of what it was about. But the feeling wasn't something you could transfer. Balthazar is like you're stepping off of whatever the street is, Prince or Spring, and you're stepping into some 15th Avenue small in Paris.
Absolutely. You know, the lighting in there is always perfect. Who was it? Ryan Sutton said something, thank God for Keith McNally's lighting. You know, he makes everyone look good. You can't put it better than that.
And the staff are great. I mean, yes. Seasoned, the men and women that work on the floor have raised families, put kids through college with the proceeds. It's one of the busiest restaurants in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, you saw there's a prep guy whose three kids work there.
Right.
You know, there's a busboy whose daughter is a waiter there. You know?
So 300 plus employees.
350, yeah.
350 employees. Yeah. A restaurant that doesn't stop. On a busy day, Balthazar does 14, 15, 16, 17, 1800 covers, which is insane. Consistently good food. We observe lunch service, dinner service. I was at Minetta the other night with my son for dinner before a concert at the Blue Note. And, of course, that place fills up early. We had a 6 o'clock res. The place was basically packed at 6 o'clock. And by the time we were leaving at 7:15 to catch a concert, it was
it's hard to walk out of there.
Hard to walk out, three deep at the bar. But the buzz of the place meant you don't want to leave. No. It's like a drug.
Yeah.
It's just exceptional. Yeah, Keith gets it.
Keith has it. You know, he's got, you know, I was lucky to do the project in London with him.
That's right. You all opened Balthazar London. That's right.
Yeah. And I got to watch him, you know, for lack of a better word, nitpick and redesign and rethink everything. Everything. Like the sign that went to the toilet. You know, he changed it twice. You know, because he didn't like the way it looked. And he didn't think that people would like to read the, like, you know, here in New York it says toilets. But over there it says something else. I can't think of what it says. But it's a French word for toilets.
Right.
But anyways, you know, it's like it took him a week to decide on that. He still is, to this day, deciding which shades he likes better. Which color. There's two different colors. And I've been over there several times, and every time I go over there, they're different. And he's like, I'm not sure yet. I'm still thinking about it.
You name the most successful restaurateurs in New York in the last 30 years. And, of course, the names that come to mind quickly are the guys that get the most press, guys like Danny Meyer, Drew Nieperant, Steve Hansen, to a late, way lesser extent qualitative-wise, and Chattereau just for numbers purely. But in that list of the top guys, like Drew and like Danny, Keith's there. Oh, I mean, I just think he's just no one. I think everybody probably envies him because in terms of profitability, he's actually ahead of them. He's
probably, yeah.
He's fucking smart.
Yeah, he's got
freaking
it.
Smart. He's got it figured out.
He does.
Talk about the new place, if you don't mind. I am not so big on, you know, I'll leave that to the eaters of the world and the bloggers of the world. I tend to give restaurants 6 months to a year after they open before I even try them because there's a settling in period that has to happen. But so Polino's on Houston is now shuttered. It's going to reopen as Cherche Midi. Right now it's a construction site. If as much as you want to reveal about who's going to be involved, who's going to be doing the cooking, talk to us about that. But I'd like to know about the food because each Balthazar is kind of like the brasserie. It's big, it's voluminous, it's not inexpensive, but it's not expensive. It does breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week, never closes. Yeah. It feeds downtown Manhattan and Soho. Minette is a little more precious. Minette is a little more expensive, a little more elevated. The menus, it's not an inexpensive place to dine. It's fabulous. Incredible burger, incredible meat, and really interesting dishes. I mean, I had the pied de cochon because, man, I ain't making that at home. And you know what? I would go back and have that once a week.
It's awesome.
Insane.
It wouldn't kill you if you ate it once a week?
It would kill me.
Yeah.
So I'm not eating it once a week. And then Schiller's on my end of town is like a bit of a down market because it's Lower East Side.
Yeah.
It cannot be Minetta. It's not trying to be Minetta. It's beautiful. It's cool. You oversee that menu. Same menu almost all day long.
Yep.
So what are we looking at for Cherche Midi? Each of these products is a little bit different.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you ask because I just had lunch at La Grenouille.
No. How was it, by the way?
It was awesome.
Was it?
Yeah. I was with the pastry chef and the chef de cuisine. Laura Wirtz is going to be the pastry chef. She's the pastry chef at Mirandi right now. And she was the pastry chef at Polino's as well. And then Daniel Perillo, or Chino, as everybody calls him, he's going to be chef de cuisine. He is the executive sous chef at Minetta Tavern. He's been there since it opened.
Great guy. Slick back hair, ponytail, major tattoos on his neck. I mean, lives in the village. I used to see him all the time walking around in the West Village.
Been around forever. He worked at Boulay. He worked for Josh DeCellis. He worked for Zach Palacio. You know, he was the chef at 5-9th. You know, he's been around. Awesome guy. Incredible cook. Very talented. I can't wait to work with him.
So Chino, it's official. Chino's going to be the chef.
Chino's it, yeah.
Okay.
Chino's it.
Okay.
The food, you know, we've been very fortunate to taste it a lot. We've been doing a lot of things, and we're going back towards classics. You know, we're going to try to do, you know, that's kind of why we went to Grenouille today. Was just we're trying to dip our toes back into that classic thing and make it where people will enjoy it again, because, you know, Dan alluded to it and you said it. You know, there's no dots and there's no foams and things like that. You know, we're going to do simple stuff. Pain soufflé. You know, we talked about this.
Yeah.
You know, pain soufflé is something that is laborious.
Pain in the ass, dude. Yeah.
And we're going to do it. And
almost 50-50 success to failure rate. Yeah. Why they don't, I mean, I've never figured it out why. I'll never forget my kids were lucky enough. When they were little and Jacques Rechoux was still at the Côte Basque, I took my family to the Côte Basque, wife and kids. And Jacques came out to the table with a couple of the courses himself. Yeah. And one of them was pain soufflé. My kids had never seen them. In a napkin, presented the way you'd open up that folded napkin. And in it was like 20, 22 of these beautiful globes of potato ping pong balls, man.
They're
insane.
Awesome.
They're so good.
I've been playing around with those, you know, like blanching different ways and freezing them and trying to just get it down. So that, you know, those are the kind of things that we're working on. That we're working with Pat LaFreda on a dry age program. You know, we got a burger. You know, it's Keith. We have to have a burger. Classic stuff, consomme, things like that. We're just going to try to bring food. And one of Keith's formulas is there's a little something for everybody. And that's where we're going. It's going to be a small menu, like Minetta. You know, I think I said, you know, it's a feminine version of Minetta Tavern.
You had mentioned that, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. Still that way, so maybe a little more on the vegetable salad fish side.
Yes. There's definitely some meats. There's stuff for the boys. But there's definitely some great salads, lots of vegetables. You know, that on the opposite, flip side of Minetta, you know. And it's just going to be emphasis on the ingredients. You know, if there's one thing that I brought into Balthazar was, you know, kind of paying attention to what we were buying. I work every day with our purchaser. I talk to him all the time. You know, and I'm always trying to get something a little bit better for us. You know, we're not cheap. You know, it's hard to do a restaurant for cheap these days. Grenouille was expensive. You know, it was expensive. When you're paying union waiters, you got to kick up the price. But we're looking for, you know, just doing nice, really nice, simple stuff. That's kind of the goal.
Well, that's what Keith's always done. I mean, if you think of, even going back to Odeon days with Patrick Clark in the kitchen, Balthazar opened in the late 90s, Pastis after that, but it was not to reinvent anything. It was to just go back to that huge, I mean, and you and I talked about, we collect cookbooks.
Yeah.
Oh, it's funny, my copy of Lunch at Pavillon is the first edition, too. Or Dinner at Pavillon.
Awesome.
First edition.
I don't have
the dust cover, but it's first edition. A little less. No, but it's still, they're going for like $500-$600. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So you and I still collect, we're geeks, we've got old French cookbooks, and if you go, I mean, a double consomme, a chilled consomme in the summer. Is there anything better? I mean, on a cold winter night, a double consomme with dumplings floating in it. In the summer, a chilled lobster consomme, a chilled chicken consomme with brunoise. I mean, it's like, this is perfect food. Yeah. It never goes out of style.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's like, you know, it's like a nice pair of loafers. They never go out of style.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. We're just going to do food that is executed as perfectly as we can do it, using the best ingredients we get our hands on, and going back and bringing some classics back. That's really the focus.
Well, you know, Polina was the only place Keith opened that opened and closed in a shorter period of time than one would have expected, for a whole bunch of different reasons, I'm sure. I don't know, and I'm not going to opine on that. But I suspect Shishimidi is going to be a sticker, because everything he's done, I mean, Pastis just closed the other night, you know, got a lot of press, everyone's going to miss it. There's talk of reinventing it. I'm sure he's talking to landlords about finding a space.
That's already in motion.
Good. So Keith's got it.
Oh, yeah.
Good for you. And your day is 6 days a week?
What's that?
You're 6 days a week?
Me?
Yeah.
This week I am. 7 days a week.
When is Shishimidi going to open? What are we looking at? What do we think?
Hopefully end of April, beginning of May.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So before I disappear for Cape May for my July in August.
Yeah, we're hoping to be end of spring.
Okay.
That's our knock on wood.
I look forward to it. Chino's a great guy. Love his food at Minetta. He's solid. I'm sure you get the A-team in there.
Yeah.
Shane, thanks so much for coming in, man.
Yeah.
Shane McBride, I wish we had another half an hour to wax poetically. I'll get him back maybe as Cherchez getting ready to go in the menu set. We can talk about the menu specifically. I'm the host, Mike Colomeco. You've been listening to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk. My guests were Dan Silverman, the chef uptown at the Regency Bar and Grill, and Shane McBride, who oversees an enormous swath of restaurant real estate these days with restaurants like Minetta Tavern, Balthazar, Schiller's, and the soon-to-open Cherchez Midi down on Houston Street by the Bowery. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, man.
Pleasure. And thanks for the wine. Tell me about this wine. Where'd you... this is a delicious...
I got it right around the corner.
This guy?
Yeah.
That store.
Right there.
I picked up two bottles of wine tonight because I'm having dinner. I love Thursday nights. I'm going to chill. I'm going to take a pizza home, watch some basketball tonight, smoke a cigar in my apartment. Guy's night out, man. Just me.
Yeah.
Great selection.
This one called my name. I'm like, that's perfect for the weather right there.
Perfect. Cobiel, thanks so much. We can congratulate when I see him on the way out. Again, Shane McBride, chef at Minetta Tavern, soon to open. Share Shane McD. Check it out when it happens. If you haven't been to Minetta or Balthazar, I'm saving you a round trip ticket to Paris because it's pretty hard to find any experience like that in New York. That authentic. Great places. And congratulations on your success.
Thank you, man.
All right. See you next week, folks. Who's my... You know what? I'm going to promo next week's show. I wrote it down. I do this every week, and I fuck it up. So hold on. Hold on. I'm going to tell you who are my guests next week, because I never remember. Oh, yeah. I've got Ben Hirschberger, who was the head baker for Per Se for many, many years. He was a pastry chef baker in charge of the bread program. He's now at Hot Bread Kitchen, which is an amazing story up in Harlem. He's going to talk about hot bread. Hot bread's cool as shit.
Cool place, yeah.
I want to get Jessamine in here, but she was away that day. And then I've got another New York vet coming in, Bill Telepan. So next week, Ben Hirschberger is going to talk Hot Bread Kitchen, Bill Telepan about his restaurant Uptown and his new one, Telepan Local. That's next week. Hey, see you then, folks. Be well. Eat well often.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.